my name is John Chung. Thank you for listening to Totally Awesome Films, where I discuss some of the greatest films ever made. Each week, I watch a movie, talk about what I thought of the movie, research a little bit about how it got made, and discuss why I think the film is totally awesome. In this podcast, we're going to talk about the 12th movie in the Eon James Bond franchise and the 5th Roger Moore James Bond, For Your Eyes Only. Now, I'm at an important point in my James Bond project. So I saw this movie when it premiered in the theaters when I was 12 years old. And For Your Eyes Only is a point at which I started to really enjoy watching the Bond movies as they were coming out in the theaters. Even though Moonraker was the first movie I saw in the theaters, I think For Your Eyes Only is the one I really enjoyed and really saw over and over again. I actually ended up seeing it in the theaters twice, and then another, you know, numerous times when it came on HBO. All the previous movies were watched, you know, renting them on VHS, kind of out of order, you know, here and there. But from this moment on is when I'm going to watch every single James Bond movie in order as they come out in the theaters. I think I was lucky to have seen this one first. This is a great 007 film, and it's an excellent movie overall. I've seen this movie so many times, and this is when they were playing this on cable TV, you know, and I've probably seen this just hundreds of times. And between this movie, Octopussy, and Never Seen Ever Again, I really have seen each of them over 100 times. So, you know, this movie really set the stage for my own personal Bond mania. And, you know, every once in a while it comes on TV and I'll still watch it. And, you know, at that time, I guess the world generally agreed that this was a good film, and it's generally considered one of the best films of the Roger Moore era. I mean, clearly, Spy Who Loved Me is generally considered the best Roger Moore movie, and I think most people will agree that this is the second best Roger Moore 007 film. One way I like to look at it is if you can think of Dr. No, From Russia with Love, and The Goldfinger, and arguably Thunderball, as the golden age of James Bond, then The Spy Who Loved Me, For Your Eyes Only, and Octopussy would definitely be considered the Roger Moore Silver Age. After the financial success but critical bombardment of Moonraker, the Eon producer, Cubby Broccoli, decided that he wanted to go a different direction with the James Bond franchise. He felt that if he continued on the path that the Moonraker was taking, Bond would possibly become more outlandish and more ridiculous. So in this movie, he intentionally went in a new direction, emphasizing more on seriousness, on realism, more on tension, plot, and character. So the screenwriter decided not to write a film where a megalomaniac threatens the entire world, but decided to write kind of a smaller movie and sort of a return to the Anglo-Soviet tensions of the Cold War. You know, they promoted John Glenn, who was the editor of the last two Bond films, as well as the editor on Her Majesty's Secret Service. They promoted him to the director's chair, and eventually he would go on to direct the next 5 Bond films, more than any other James Bond director. So, and it's hard to believe that Roger Moore almost did not star in this movie. Moore had signed a 3-picture deal, which ended with The Spy Who Loved Me. He agreed to do Moonraker, but was unsure if he should do a 5th movie. So Moore was concerned that he was getting too old for 007 and didn't want to do a disservice to this beloved character. So it was a classy sentiment. And, you know, and I really believe that Moore is a very thoughtful and classy gentleman. So Cubby Broccoli considered Timothy Dalton again. And they also auditioned Michael Billington again, you know, who played Triple X's lover in The Spy Who Loved Me. Fortunately, at the last minute, they were able to iron out some last-minute details, and Roger Moore agreed to do one more film. And I'm really glad he did, because I think this is his finest work. People may think that Spy Who Loved Me is a better movie, per se, but I think, For Eyes Only, Roger Moore gives the better performance in this, and arguably he gives the best performance as James Bond in this film. Interestingly, this is also the last film released by United Artists. United Artists had released all the previous movies for Eon. However, United Artists is going to end up with some financial difficulties, and at the last minute, they're going to merge with MGM. So starting in the mid-80s, James Bond will no longer become a United Artists property, but will become a UA-MGM property. Now, however, in the 1990s, it's going to be a time of more corporate shuffling with multiple mergers and splits between MGM and UA. And finally, in the year 2000, United Artists is going to become a specialty studio owned by MGM. However, United Artists' top three franchises, Rocky Balboa franchise, the Pink Panther franchise, and the James Bond franchise, are going to be moved under the MGM banner. And to this day, MGM releases and distributes the James Bond properties. Carol Bouquet stars as the Bond girl, Melina Havelock, and she is one of my all-time favorite Bond girls, probably because she was really the first Bond girl, since this is the first Bond movie that I'm going to really get into. And I think she is insanely beautiful, and she has this sort of subtle, violent intensity mixed with a very likable and charismatic vulnerability. And she totally won me over, and by the end of the movie, I'm just completely in love with her throughout the entire film. Bouquet actually was a relatively unknown French actress at the time who'd only been in five French films. However, this movie is going to launch her into international superstardom. And she's going to star in over 40 films and become the face of Chanel No. 5 for over 10 years. And in the U.S., she's primarily just known as the Bond girl from For Your Eyes Only. But in France, she is a superstar. And to this day, she still makes headlines, and paparazzi are still obsessed with her. News and gossip come out about her all the time. And she has been called, quote, the French Marilyn Monroe, unquote, for her iconic superstar status in France. You know, she's currently 56 years old, but if you Google her picture now, she still looks great. I mean, she still looks exactly like Melina Havelock, you know, when she was in her 20s. Her life is very interesting, and in some ways, it's kind of tragic, and some of the comparisons to Marilyn Monroe are somewhat valid, except the fact that she's still alive and healthy and doing well. She was even attached to Gérard Depardieu from 1997 to 2005. Remember him? In 2005, a scandal broke out when it was discovered that during the presidency of François Mitterrand, who was the French president from 1981 to 1995, that he actually secretly wiretapped her. Can you believe that? You know, now he had wiretapped a bunch of others, but she was actually one of the actresses that was wiretapped by the French president. She was also rumored by the tabloids to recently have had an affair with the recent French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, who was president from 2007 to 2012. And, you know, the tabloids claim that this president had just become obsessed with her. At this point, the affair has not been substantiated, and it is believed just to be just sort of a tabloid garbage. But at the same time, it gives you an idea of how obsessed the French public is with her right now. It should be mentioned that those are not her legs in the poster for Your Eyes Only. The model who owned those legs were unknown for years, but now we know that it was a 22-year-old model named Joyce Bartle, and the poster was photographed by Morgan Kane, and now is considered one of the most iconic posters of all time. Morgan Kane achieved that sexy effect by having the model wear her swimsuit backwards. Now, when I was a teenager, one of the urban legends was that the Bond girl in this movie was once a man. Has any of you all heard that? And of course, many people who heard that assume that it was Melina Havelock. You know, in other words, assume that Carol Bouquet was a transsexual. Of course, it wasn't. Carol Bouquet is a woman, has always been a woman. But actually, there is a transsexual who played one of the 11 women in the, you know, who were wearing bikinis in the background in the mansion scene when Locke delivers the money to Hector Gonzalez, the Cuban hitman that murdered Melina Havelock's parents. So the actress in question is Caroline Cozy, a London model who was born Barry Kenneth Cozy. And she began hormone therapy to become a woman at age 17 and then had sex reassignment surgery. And believe it or not, her life is fascinating, and it is worth mentioning here. So Caroline Cozy started her career out as a nightclub dancer, and she almost immediately became one of the most sought-out glamour models in London, and even posed for Playboy in 1981. Then, that year, she was cast as an extra in this movie, until in 1982, a tablet outed her as a transsexual. And remember, at that time, it was a different time. Society was not that hip on the concept of transsexuality. And so she began to receive death threats and began to lose all her modeling contracts. Until, this gets really kind of interesting, she met a wealthy Italian count, actual European royalty, who fell in love with her. You know, he knew she was a transsexual, and they were engaged for 4 years. She then becomes this outspoken advocate for the rights of transsexuals. And in 1983, she sued the British High Courts for transsexuals to be legally recognized as the reassigned gender. And the trial went on, and eventually went up to Europe's highest court. And after 7 years of legal battle, she won. And the European High Courts actually ruled in her favor. And it is one of the landmark cases where men who get sexually reassigned to women are now legally considered women. So to this day, she's a tireless crusader for transsexual rights and is happily married and living, believe it or not, in Atlanta, Georgia. Really fascinating individual, fascinating life. And if you're just curious about her, you can actually Google her. You know, just Google Carolyn Cossey, C-O-S-S-E-Y, and just watch some interviews. And you'll have to admit, I mean, she is absolutely a stunning, stunning woman. So another strong actor in this film is Topol, who was known as the Fiddler on the Roof. Producers apparently discovered him when they saw the 1980 Dino De Laurentiis film Flash Gordon and saw him play Dr. Hans Zarkov. Now, we're going to have to do that movie on this podcast one of these days. You know, interesting coincidence. In the case that Roger Moore did not agree to do this film, they were considering Timothy Dalton for the movie, who also was in Dino De Laurentiis' Flash Gordon. He played Prince Baron. And of course, he'll eventually go on to actually play James Bond 8 years later. Another interesting Flash Gordon connection is that the role of Melina Havelock was specifically written for Ornella Muti, who played Princess Aura in the same Dino De Laurentiis Flash Gordon movie. So this is a weird connection between Flash Gordon and Free Eyes Only. So in the opening pre-credit action sequence, the film starts with James Bond visiting the grave of his late wife, Tracy Bond. Now, when I first saw this, I was confused. So I didn't really know, had Bond ever been married? You know, when was he married? And I remember thinking that maybe it was before he became a spy. Now, of course, when I went back and started watching all the James Bond movies, I realized that this was a reference to On Her Majesty's Secret Service, where Bond got married to Tracy Bond and then eventually lost her to Blofeld. So this scene ends up being a Blofeld action sequence. Blofeld tries to kill Bond, but Bond is able to turn it around and eventually, with a helicopter, picks up Blofeld and throws him down a chimney shaft. And one can't help but see this as kind of a meta-textual middle finger to Kevin McClory, who is currently in a lawsuit with Eon at the time for his right to use the character. Then, after the pre-credit action sequence, we get one of the most famous Bond songs ever. The song For Your Eyes Only by Sheena Easton was a breakout success. The funny bit of trivia: the original song, For Your Eyes Only, was first written by Deborah Harry of Blondie, but the producers didn't like the song. They wanted her to sing the song that they'd written, which Sheena Easton eventually sang, but Deborah Harry wasn't interested. Now, if you're curious about the song, you can actually YouTube it or Google it, and you can hear it. And it's a very different song from the song we're familiar with. It's kind of like a less catchier version of Call Me. I mean, it sounds very Blondie and doesn't sound very James Bond at all. And to be honest, I really don't think it's a very good song. I think the one Sheena Easton sang is much better. And Sheena Easton is the first ever singer of a Bond song to actually appear in the opening montage. It's because the director saw her and really liked the way she looked. You know, Sheena Easton is pretty hot. Hot as any Bond girl, and they decided to put her in the opening montage. Now, John Glenn wanted a movie where James Bond has to use his wits rather than rely on cartoonish gadgets. So, in the opening act, he had his Lotus blow up, and he has to survive by driving this beat-up Citroën 2C. John Glenn stated that he intentionally inserted this as a metaphor for the new Bond direction, and I think it totally worked. The car chase is fun, it's exciting, it's energetic, it's just a great action scene, and extremely well choreographed and planned. The humble Citroën 2CV is a popular French economy car, and in 1981, Citroën released the 2CV 007 edition of their popular car. It was painted yellow, like the movie, with a 007 sticker across the side, and even sticker bullet holes all around the vehicle. And this miniature model of the car was extremely popular, and the Citroën 2CV remains one of the most iconic and popular of James Bond's cars. And the action scene is also fun to watch and still holds up to this day. Another great action scene in this movie is the ski scenes. And the ski scene in this movie is just spectacular. And we see James Bond really show off his skiing skills. It is one of the best action sequences I think ever filmed, and it's brilliantly choreographed. Even the most cynical Roger Moore haters will have to admit that this ski scene is still very good. You know, at one point, Bond skis up a ski jump wearing downhill skis, and in the highlight, he actually even skis down a bobsled course. Now, unfortunately, while filming this scene, it actually ended in tragedy. One of the stuntmen, a stuntman named Paolo Rigon, was actually killed during shooting. While shooting the bobsled scene, the bobsled apparently flipped over, and Rigon was trapped underneath, and he later died in the hospital from injuries he sustained during that accident. Now, in one of the most artistic action sequences, Bond chases the evil henchman Locke, who is driving up a monastery in Albania. And Bond runs up a flight of stairs before confronting Locke head-on. And I think this is the brilliance of John Glenn. I think a lesser director may have chosen to add music, you know, something to add to the intensity, but Bond brilliantly leaves the scene silent. And with only the quiet hum of the car superimposed on Bond's footsteps, it just sort of creates this real quiet intensity. Bond shoots Locke, who almost falls over the cliff, and then, this is kind of an interesting moment, you see Locke kind of helpless, almost pleading for help, and James Bond just looks at him and gives the car a violent kick, which makes the car fly over the cliff, killing him. And it is shocking, and Roger Moore himself even expressed concern that this might be out of character with his James Bond, but John Glenn convinced him to do it, and they were both right. It is out of character, but the scene totally works. And as a teenager watching this, it was one of the most defining aspects of Bond, showing that there is this dangerous killer underneath the likable gentleman. And in retrospect, it is one of Moore's finest moments as James Bond. The next action scene is an underwater scene, which starts with Bond and Molina scuba diving and ends with them being dragged through the sea as shark bait. And the funny thing about this scene is a lot of the scenes were actually not shot underwater. They were actually shot on a set, and air was blown and then filmed in slow motion to give the effect of being underwater. And I didn't really think about it at the time, but you know, if you know that and you watch it, you can tell that they're not underwater. But I think the scene still looks convincing. It doesn't detract from the action at all. Now, the final climax scene is one of the most clever action sequences ever. I mean, it's so simple and yet so suspenseful. James Bond rock climbs up St. Cyril's Mountain to attack the fortress. And in many ways, this was the beginning of the rock climbing fad. And it may have even helped give birth to the sport as a new sensation. I have to admit, my best friend and I, who watched this movie together, began to rock climb after this. And while it really wasn't my sport, he actually went on to become a professional-level rock climber. So I guess he can thank Fries only for fueling his passion for rock climbing. Now, the scene where Bond falls off the side of the mountain and is stopped by a single carabiner really had me on the edge of my seat. Drop was performed by stuntman Rick Sylvester. I remember him. He did the ski jump parachute scene in the opening pre-credit teaser for The Spy Who Loved Me. And he apparently said that when he did this, he himself was actually scared to do this scene. But and rightly so. The scene is terrifying, and it works really well. And I think it's such an understated action sequence, but it works so well to just maximize the suspense. Now, how many people remember that when James Bond is climbing the mountain, he actually, in one scene, reaches for a ledge and a pigeon flies out and scares him, and us, the audience? Well, apparently, that is John Glenn's trademark. He always tries to have a flying pigeon scaring the protagonist in almost every movie he's in. And he believes that it invests the audience in the scene. This happens in Free Eyes Only, when Bond is climbing St. Cyril's. It happens in Octopussy, when James Bond is climbing the ledge of Kamal Khan's house. It happens in Living Daylights, when he's at night, ready to attack Whitaker's house. Bond is scared by pigeons. It also happens in License to Kill, when James Bond is ready to put explosive toothpaste in front of Sanchez's window, pigeons come out and scare him. The only film not to have it is A View to a Kill, where instead of pigeons, you get a cat that gives him the false scare. And that's when Bond is at Stacey Sutton's house. Apparently, the director John Glenn and Roger Moore had a great working relationship. John Glenn loved working with Roger Moore, and Roger Moore the same. And in fact, in 2007, it was Roger Moore that wrote John Glenn's biography. So that's pretty cool. Now, here's an interesting bit of trivia. Pierce Brosnan visited the set of For Your Eyes Only when he was only 23 years old. At that time, he was married to Cassandra Harris, who played Countess Liesel von Schlaff. She's the first Bond girl who gets killed when she's hit by some assassins in a doom buggy. The entire production team, as well as producer Albert Broccoli, was really fascinated by Brosnan, and they were really, I'm sure they were all thinking the same thing, that this guy looks like he could be the next James Bond. And so Albert Broccoli took Pierce Brosnan and Cassandra Harris out to lunch, and was even quoted to saying, quote, "If he can act, he's my guy," unquote. And of course, the next year, Brosnan was cast in Remington Steele, proving that he could act and would be inching closer to one day playing Bond, although that wouldn't happen for another 14 years. Now, something very odd happened during the premiere of this film. The premiere was shown to Prince Charles and his fiancée at the time, Lady Diana Spencer, at a charity benefit for the Royal Association for Disability and Rehabilitation. So nothing wrong with that, right? It seemed like a good idea. Well, until the opening scene, when Bond is throwing a man in a wheelchair down a chimney chute, it caused a lot of people, a lot of royal and wealthy elite people of England, to complain about the insensitivity of the producers. And, you know, I gotta admit, they kinda had a point. But, however, the movie did go on to become a huge financial success. The movie made $54 million in the U.S., which is equivalent to about $141 million in 2013 dollars when adjusted for inflation. And it became the second highest grossing Bond film ever, only slightly less than Moonraker. It went on to make $194 million worldwide, which is equal to about $509 million in 2013 dollars. In fact, the financial success of this movie probably saved United Artists. United Artists had just lost $40 million off of Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate in 1980, and United Artists had to file for bankruptcy. And when this film raked in $194 million at the box office, it saved United Artists from directly just going under, and probably set up the scenes that allowed for the MGM merger, which allowed for UA's survival to this day. After this movie, Roger Moore believed that he would not return to James Bond. Again, he felt that he was getting way too old to play an action star and was concerned that he was doing this character a disservice. The producers began to audition other actors, including American actor James Brolin. They also interviewed Lambert Wilson and perennial favorite Timothy Dalton. However, in my next podcast, I'm going to talk about factors that led to Roger Moore returning as James Bond for what he thought would be one more film. So For Your Eyes Only, arguably one of the best Bond films. It holds its own, I think, against some of the best of the Connery films. I've personally seen it over 100 times, and it ranks as one of my favorite movies from my childhood. You must go and see this movie if you haven't seen it. That's all for this podcast. I ask that you please go like our Facebook page. That's Totally Awesome Films. and leave a comment if you wish. Also, subscribe to Totally Awesome Films on iTunes. It's completely free. And leave a rating, preferably a 4-star rating, and that'll help us show up on searches. And join us next week for a discussion of the 13th James Bond film, Octopussy. Thank you for listening. I hope you had a good time.